Good morning. Thank you all for joining us this morning. I know it's early. We appreciate you being here. I'm Marlene Vogelsang with Bill Nallen. We are pinch hitting for Stu Thornley, who couldn't be with us today for our scores committee meeting. And we're delighted to see so many of you with us here today. We are really thrilled to welcome two scorers from the Pittsburgh team, Bob Webb and Evan Patek, who are going to talk to us about how they became scorers, talk to us about the process of scoring, and be here to answer all of our questions. So I want to welcome them. I want to welcome you, and let's get this started. Evan?
Thank you, Marlene. Good morning. You may have read in the past couple weeks of the death of the longtime Pirates pitcher Bruce Keeson. Bruce Keeson got me into scoring, however inadvertently. And this was what happened. Through the 1979 season, the official scorers in Pittsburgh were the baseball beat writers for three newspapers here the Post-Gazette, the Press, and the McKee Sport Daily News. And late in the 79 season, Keeson took a no-hitter into the late innings of a game against San Diego. And a Pirate hit a ball down the third baseline that the third baseman couldn't handle. The official scorer was Dan Donovan of the Pittsburgh Press, and he ruled it a hit, ending the no-hitter. And everybody in the park agreed with the call except for Keeson, as you might guess. And this created a very awkward situation for Dan, as he was the beat writer. He was covering the game, and so he then had to go into the locker room after the game and ask Keeson, what'd you think of the call? And, of course, it was his call, and Bruce let him know in no uncertain terms. And at that point, the newspapers realized that they were placing their beat writers in untenable situations. And at the end of the 1979 season, they banned their beat writers from scoring, a ban that persists until this day, although only one of the newspapers persists until this day. So at the beginning of the 1980 season, there were no returning scorers. And at the time, I was a sports columnist for Pittsburgh Magazine. And my wife, Paula Smith, covered the Pirates as the regional sports editor here for UPI. And I ran quotes for her, although she went into the locker room sometimes, which is another messy story. So I was always at the ballpark and thought scoring might be fun. I'd always kept score at baseball games, and there was no formal application process. To this day, there is no formal application process. You kind of let the home club know that you're interested, and they give you sort of an informal audition. And that's how I was hired. But that first year was strange. Three scorers were hired eventually. One of them was working his second game. It was a game against the Mets, and was full of difficult hit error calls. And then midway through the game, he got into one of those situations where he had runs that were earned against the team but unearned against the relief pitcher. That might come up a couple times in your career, right? Unluckily for him, it came up in his second game. And you may remember Jack Lang, the old president of the Baseball Writers Association who covered the Mets. Jack was very impatient with this guy and was kind of screaming at him from the back row. And after the game, he quit. So that left us with two scorers. Then about mid-August, I got a call from my remaining colleague, and he said, you know, now that I'm retired, my wife and I would like to travel, and so I'm resigning as scorer. And I thought, didn't you know you were going to do that when you accepted the position? But nevertheless, for the last 6 weeks of the 1980 baseball season, I was the only scorer here. And that's too much baseball, no matter how much you love it. When you've got to watch every pitch of every game, that's too much. And fortunately, the National League hired some new scores. Bob came along a few years later. Interesting to note, you might not be aware of this, but in those days, scoring was a matter of the leagues. It wasn't unified as it is today. Now, we're hired by MLB. MLB is in charge. But back then, it was very much like the umpires. The National League had its scores. The American League had its scores. So it was a tumultuous first year of scoring for me.
Well, thank you, Evan. My story builds upon that. I'll take you back to August 1989, and I was sitting in the stands one day and with a couple of friends, and there was a hit-error play, and so we discussed it, and I turned to my friend and I said, well, what's your opinion? And he gave it, and I said, well, you're so good, you should be an official scorer. And he said, well, yes, but I'm a reporter for the press, and as Evan indicated, you can't be a scorer. And he said, well, you should be a scorer. And I said, well, that's an interesting notion, but I have no idea how to do it. So I looked up in the I asked, well, who are the scorers? He gave me their names, and I said, well, Paddock. I should be able to find that in a phone book that existed at that time. So I looked up the name Evan Paddock, and I dialed him up, and I said, well, Evan, is there any process? And as he said today, no, there's no particular process, but if you call the Pirates, maybe they'll have you come and sit for a game or two and see what you can do. Well, I had done scoring in college and had been involved in baseball in the Pittsburgh area for a while. So I came and I sat with Evan and our colleague at that point and sat for three games. And then they said, well, we don't know what's going to happen. The Pirates said, we don't know what's going to happen either. So Pirates go on a road trip and I go on vacation. And then August 29th, 1989 dawns and it's time for me to go to work. So I put my suit on and I head for downtown and it's about 9 o'clock in the morning and I get a call from the Pirates and they said, well, one of the official scorers has vacation and the other one has a death in the family. We're going to send you a test from New York today and if you pass it, you're tonight's official scorer. And so I then had to call my wife. And I said to her, with three very young kids at home, I had to say, well, I won't be home tonight. And she said, well, why won't you be home? I said, well, I'm going to the ballpark. She said, no, you're not going to the ball. I said, well, no, I'm going to be the official scorer. And she said, well, you've come up with a lot of very interesting stories over the time, but that's the best one. So on August 29th, 1989, I was indeed the official scorer, and we have meetings with official scorers in New York every year, and I passed the story around, and it was determined that I'm the only one probably in the history of Major League Baseball that scored a game as an official scorer while waking up that day not knowing that I was going to be an official scorer, even intending to go to the ballpark. So there is a certain haphazard way of becoming a scorer, but I certainly thank Evan for his helping me get into the business and for his guidance during the time that I've been a scorer.
What other kind of work do you do? you do?
Well, I'm a lawyer by profession. I started by practicing law. I got into public service for a number of years, and I was the county manager of Allegheny County, which is the city of Pittsburgh and the surrounding 130 municipalities. So ordinarily before a group like this, what I would be doing is thanking you for coming to Pittsburgh and welcoming you here, which I will do. I've also done some teaching at Carnegie Mellon University, and right now I'm leading the operations of a Pittsburgh law firm.
And you have a new colleague, Mike, that I just met on the other night, Tuesday night, I guess.
New colleague is Jack.
Jack.
And I want to mention this, too, because important for both Evan and I, we had a very long-term colleague, Tony Krzmanich, who served almost as long as Evan and unfortunately passed away very suddenly on opening day this year. And so Major League Baseball then went through the process of hiring another scorer who has just begun with the first couple of games this year.
What about you, Evan? What do you do during the day?
I'm a writer and a publicist. I do a lot of freelance magazine writing.
Sports?
General. I'm a generalist. I'll just give me the assignment and I'll do it. And my largest client here from the PR standpoint is the Meadows Racetrack and Casino. I work exclusively on the harness racing side. Yeah, it's interesting, not lucrative, but interesting.
Do you keep score at harness racing?
Well, harness racing, my responsibility. You know, if anybody's in PR, you know you get all the stuff that nobody else wants to do. So, we have a cable TV show in which we broadcast the races, and I co-host that once or twice a week, and I write all of the press releases about our featured races and those kind of things. But there's no actual scorekeeping in harness racing, although we do have people whom we call charters who I guess they'd be the closest equivalent. They chart the progress of the horse, all the horses in the race, throughout the race, so they can tell you not only who's leading and who's second and who's fourth, but how many lengths behind they are and if they were racing on the outside or the inside. So it's kind of a rough equivalent of scoring.
I think it's very impressive that in recent years Major League Baseball has brought you all to New York to confer amongst yourselves to look at, I mean, you actually look at plays on video and so forth, right? Review plays from the prior year. Try to get you all more on the same page. That's an investment they make in a significant investment.
They do pick the coldest weekend in January for us to go there. They don't take us to the winter meetings in the sunny places. Major League Baseball has taken an initiative over the last 5 or 6 years. Scorers are invited to New York, and the purpose of that is for us to review any new rules that may be in place, but most importantly to be able to look at video of plays that have occurred during the course of the year and get a sense of how they were scored. And there is now a process that's been in play for two Major League Baseball player agreements, which allows a individual player or the club to appeal a scorer's decision. And so there is now a process that we go through, and the idea was to ensure that we consistently evaluated and responded to those appeals so that they would be effectively decided.
I'm very curious about your game day process. Could you sort of walk us through what happens?
Well, the actual preparation isn't intensive. We fill out our the lineups, and if you keep score, you'd recognize what we do. There's no magic or mystique about it, but there may be a couple of things that we do differently. Let me get out a visual aid here, such as it is.
I always, once in a while, I enjoy going to the scorer in Boston during the course of a game, maybe the seventh or eighth inning, and say, I see on the scoreboard it says 6-2, but what's the official score?
Well, Evan's getting this. One of the things that I do that maybe just a little different is I look to the notes and often talk to the visiting public relations person just so I can be able to pronounce the names of the opposing pitchers, because we have to give the lines when they're done, and I'd hate to butcher the name of an individual who's been pitching.
Yeah, I always listen to our stadium announcer for that, and he's never wrong. So however he pronounces a name, I follow suit. But this is an ordinary tablet, but this is an important tool for us, because as you know, among our responsibilities is at the end of the game immediately announcing the totals for each team, the winning and losing pitcher, if there's a saved involved, the time of game, and so on. And you can put yourself in a mad scramble if you're not keeping track of all that as it happens. And so on this tablet, I'm keeping track of all of that as it happens. There are runs, hits, errors, and LOB for each team. I've got the lines for the winner, save, losing pitcher, I've got time of game here, and of course, in the last couple of years, I've had to add a line here for reviews of challenges. One of our responsibilities is to time those and announce the times. I think MLB at some point wants to be able to evaluate how much time is going into reviews, whether it represents a savings over the arguments that it that forestalls, you know. So this is something that probably you wouldn't do if you keep score, but it enables us, and I'm sure Bob has a similar technique, but this enables us to be very quick when announcing totals, winning, losing pitcher, and all that, because media, one of the things that's different about media today is that deadlines are constant. You know, when you only had print media covering the game, you knew that if you got them the material by 11 or 11:30 or whatever their deadline was that evening, they were okay, and you might be able to take your time. But now you've got broadcast media and internet media there, and their deadlines are every minute. And so there's a renewed emphasis on speed in getting them this information. And if you don't have something like this to track things in real time that you're going to need to announce, you're digging a deep hole for yourself.
And let me describe how deep that hole is, because in my first full year, I hadn't learned that technique yet. And the Pirates were batting in the bottom of the ninth inning, and they had runners on second and third. They're down one run. And there was a single to right center field. And so I'm late in recognizing that the game is just about to end. So I furiously go down on my sheet and begin to try to do the runs, hits, and errors, left on base, winning and losing pitcher, time of game, and things of that sort. And then I grab the microphone and I say, totals for tonight's game. And I start reading it, and I hear a chorus of, whoa, ho, ho. And it turns out that the man from second stumbled going around third and didn't score, and the game wasn't over. I realized at that point a technique needed to be adopted rapidly to ensure that I didn't repeat that. And so I have my own sheet. We all do it somewhat differently. Our new scorer came and was that was one of the things that we had to let him know, is that you have to be anticipating a lot of different things, especially at the end of the game. And you have to have techniques in order to ensure that whatever happens, I mean, there are going to be inevitably hits and errors and different left on base, and sometimes you flip winning and losing pitchers, and that inevitable, up, what was the time of the game type of thing. So I have my own sheet, and now Jack, with just a few days into the thing, I believe he has his as well.
Let me add one more thing about this. And again, this is maybe something you don't utilize when you score. Why would you? You don't have to. But one of the other things that we're expected to announce very quickly is the status of runs, that is, whether they're earned or unearned. And as soon as that half inning is over, we've got to make an announcement. Again, if you haven't been keeping track of it and you go back and reconstruct that inning, it could take you a few minutes or longer to be able to determine earned versus unearned runs. And so when I find there's an error in an inning or multiple errors and they lead to runs, on the bottom of this sheet, I do the hypothetical. What should have happened with perfect play, right? Well, we should have men on second with two outs and one in. When there are three outs and I see there only should be one in, but there are three runs in, I know that two of them are unearned, and I don't have to go backtrack and waste time. And this is not something that you learn or utilize from day one of scoring. You get into that situation like Bob did when you're at a loss and you need the numbers immediately, and you say, wow, there's got to be a better way for us to do this. And I think we all have variations on a theme, but I'd be willing to bet you that every scorer does just about this same thing.
And it's all done manually?
Well, I do everything manually. We are responsible for filing a report after each game that essentially translates what we've written into our on our scorebooks into a report that Major League Baseball archives. I don't know that they use them for any other purposes, but they're archives for historical use. If you're a researcher, for example, they can pull out the those reports from any game you want to look at, and you can sort of reconstruct the game. But we do have an automated option that we can use for those reports. I still do it manually, but I think, Bob, you're using the digital option.
I am. And let me just add, too, there are two key things that we're doing after the game. One has to be done very rapidly, and the other one we can take our time doing. And that is Major League Baseball has a person doing the input during the course of the game, and they're detailing all of the plays, and that's generating a report, which is then printed out and handed around the press box. And looks like this. I'll hand these things out for people who want to take a look at them. And it gives you all the statistics for the game. It gives you putouts and assists and all of the things that have happened. It's our job to examine this and to ensure that it's correct. And so the MLB person awaits our signal that it is okay for sending, and then it's sent out for purposes of updating all the statistics in New York and becomes available worldwide. It's then our responsibility thereafter to do a similar report. It's this long document. We've done it by hand for a number of years. This is the first year it's available to be done electronically. There's a gentleman, there's a physician at the Mayo Clinic who put together this for Major League Baseball. He's an official scorer in Minnesota. And it allows us to do this during the course of the game and save a little time. But it's also, for those of us who are mathematically challenged, it is a Excel spreadsheet, so when you're adding up things, they need to balance, or you get these big red numbers that show up, and you know that it's wrong, and that's very helpful. Our experience in doing this, I'm sure Evan has the same, is that it can be particularly painful after a long evening to have to do this by hand or even by computer. I've had the pleasure of doing the two longest games in time ever played in Pittsburgh, the longest one being 5 hours and 55 minutes, an 18-inning game, which then took me an hour and 45 minutes after the game to do the handwritten report. That was another one where my wife was wondering where I was at the end of the evening. But it is a responsibility that we have to complete that report before the before we leave the press box and to send it electronically, either by fax or what I do by email to the Elias Sports Bureau, which is the entity which accepts them and then puts them into the database.
In the first year of our replay recently, you heard, and at least in some parks, maybe you all did, you heard the conversation between the umpire and the replay center, or was that just accidental occasionally? But you don't hear their conversation, right? You just intuit what the decision has been by, I mean, see the safer out.
The home public relations person actually has a headset and is connected to the conversation so that you see the umpires conversing with New York. Also, the home public relations person is in on that conversation, so that individual will announce what the decision is, whether it's confirmed stands or obviously overturned,
right.
And then it's our job to announce the time of the event.
You have a lot of conversation, well, not a lot, but ongoing conversation during the course of the game with, sometimes representatives of both teams.
Well, in the prior to the broadening of the appeal process so that individual players were authorized to appeal scorers' calls, I would say there was regular communication between the clubs and the players and the coaches and the scorers. We were lobbied fairly regularly. In almost all cases, they were cordial and polite. Rare was there any name calling. It did happen, but now that players can appeal any call, why argue with the score? Why lobby the score? Just call your agent, tell them to file an appeal, and that's what they do. So our contact with players, managers, coaches now is negligible.
Fortunately, Evan and I have had long enough opportunity to score that we did have the ability to experience that prior time, though, when ours was the final word. I had a particularly interesting day on August 31st, 2008. That was a game in which Milwaukee was playing in Pittsburgh. And in the fifth inning, Andy LaRoche was at bat, and he topped the ball towards the mound. And the pitcher at that time, C.C. Sabathia, went to field the ball and was barehanded and was unable to come up with it. I scored a hit, and as it turns out, that was the only hit of the game. To say that the folks in Milwaukee had some slight disagreement with my call is to understate the case. They replayed for me in a variety of different ways what they called me, none of which I'll say over this microphone. And it ended up with a national kind of controversy, so much so that I have three adult sons, and they're spread out throughout the country. And, of course, this was a Labor Day weekend, and it's in the evening, and they all happen to be in taverns, all watching television sets with the sound down. And they look up on it, and they see their father's picture up on the television set, and they call home immediately saying, is Dad dead? Is Dad indicted? Why is Dad on the TV screen? So many of us have welcomed the appeal process as a different way of adjudicating these kinds of issues.
Is there a backup in the booth with you?
No. Let me amend that. All games during the regular season and the first couple rounds of the postseason have a single score, and there is no backup. At the World Series, during the World Series, typically MLB engages a panel of scores. There are usually three scores for those, and that's true of the All-Star game also.
And once again, going way back, you're in a city that has seen spare amounts of playoffs in recent years, but dating back to 1992, which is the third and final year of a three-year run for the Pirates in which they were in the playoffs, I was given the opportunity to score the playoff round here in Pittsburgh, and a gentleman approached me before the game, and he said, well, I'm a writer from San Francisco, and I've been assigned to score the game with you. And I looked at him, and I said, who else? And he said, well, no, I'm the only one. And I said, well, let's think about that for a second. If we have a hit or error thing, if we have 15 people or 871, we can divide that, and there'll be one side bigger than the other. But I said, if you do hit and I do error, what is the call going to be? So he was very accommodating, and he said, well, how about if we do it this way? It's your home park. You do the hits and errors, and I'll do the more technical earned run, unearned runs, and those kinds of things. I said, fine. And it was shortly thereafter, I think, that Major League Baseball came to the conclusion, as Evan has just indicated, that you got to do an odd number, so it's either one or three now.
We're about halfway through the time here. I don't know. Often there's a sheet that gets passed around asking people to sign up and indicate that you're here. That didn't seem to be practical in a room this size with people spread out so often. But if you are not already signed up with the Official Scorers Committee, send an email to Stu Thornley or look in the book. And if you're interested, you can join and be kept apprised of the various things. There are a number of interviews that are done of scorers over time. I've done a couple of from people in Boston, and other people in other cities have done the same. It just there'd be other ways that you can learn more and participate. We should take some questions and answers, but I thought maybe we might ask each of you if you had a kind of a favorite story or an incident of some kind that, you've already detailed one or two, but.
I'll do one. Mine is a play that occurred in that same year that I just described, 1992. We're on September 20th, 1992, sixth inning. Pirates at bat, Curt Schilling pitching for the Phillies. First man up, Andy Van Slyke singles. Second man up, Barry Bonds singles. The batter is Jeff King. The count goes to 3-2. Pitch comes in, runners break. And you may anticipate what I'm about to tell you, which is that's when the line drive is hit directly to Mickey Morandini. as he's covering second base. He stands on second base catching it, and Barry Bonds runs into the tag for the unassisted triple play, the rarest play in baseball. The odd feature about that one is because it tells a tale of a different time, because Morandini, in completing the unassisted triple play, which I had time just to pick up the mic and say, triple play, second base, unassisted, he takes the ball and he rolls it back to the mound, and the ball's put in play and lost forever, something you wouldn't see happen today. But that was a particularly special moment in my scoring history.
Let me give you a couple of incidents, both from my first year of scoring. As I said, that was a tumultuous season that helped helped establish my approach to scoring. In a mid-season game here against the Cubs, the Pirates were ahead a couple runs in a late inning, and Omar Marino was on first base, took off for second and made it, and I ruled stolen base. Well, the Cubs' traveling secretary, of all people, comes flying out of the back row. He's got his rule book open to the stolen base category, and he says, they didn't even make a play on him. It was defensive indifference. You shouldn't have awarded a stolen base. Now, in 1980, and this may be hard to remember, relief pitchers didn't automatically deliver from the stretch as they do today. If they didn't have a runner on base, they wound up. At least most of them did. So I pointed out to this guy, I said, well, you know, the pitcher delivered from the stretch. So he wasn't indifferent to Marino's advance. So I'm going to keep it a stolen base. Now, fast forward to the last day of the season, last game of the season. Marino is leading the National League in stolen bases by one. The man in second place, Ron LaFleur, is injured, and he's not expected to play. But he talked his way into the lineup as a pinch runner. Steals second, steals third, and wins the stolen base title. Now, I know the stolen base title doesn't have the same catch it as the batting title or the ERA title, but still, it's not unimportant within the context of baseball. And so here was a call that seemed perfectly ordinary at the time and yet might have played a major impact in who was the stolen base leader. That same season, it was late in the season, the September series against the Cardinals here. And the Pirates PR director at the time was a guy named Joe Safety, who went on to do similar work for the Yankees for many years. And I'm getting ready for the game, and Joe comes up and he puts his arm around me and he says, we'll back your call, whatever call you make, we'll back it. And I thought, what is he talking about? Then I looked at the statistics package, right? And I was so raw, so new to this job, that I didn't realize that there was a three-way race for the batting title going on in the last few days of the season. And two of the protagonists, Keith Hernandez and Gary Templeton, were Cardinals. And they were here for the game. And now I realize that the hits and errors calls could be very important indeed. And that's why Joe was trying to give me a little encouragement. And what I took from these incidents as a whole was that any call you make, however routine it may seem, can be important within the context of baseball's statistical record, right? You decide something's not an error rather than a hit. Not an error, it's a hit. You could be extending somebody's errorless streak, right? You may not know that for the next 40 games or 80 games, but your call at the time could be contributing to that. Same thing with batting streaks. A seemingly innocuous call that you make can perpetuate or end a batting streak. So what I took away from that in that crazy first season of scoring was that you cannot take a play off. You can't ever allow your attention to wander. You can't get distracted by chats with people who are sitting near you, because every call you make can end up being significant, although you probably won't realize its significance at the time.
Want to open it up for questions?
Sure.
There is a microphone in the room. Good.
I'd like to ask you, as I understand it, you have up to 24 hours to change a call.
Yes.
I was wondering what the process was, what are the situations that bring that about, and how do you go about that if you have some question about what went on in the field, or you had a situation where you're still not sure whether it was a hit or an error quite, and you want to further deal with the player. How does that work?
Well, I'll speak only to my experience, and that is that you only see the play once, and from my perspective, you ultimately have to make a judgment, and that in my view, you make that judgment, and especially now in an era where there is an appeal process, that's the judgment that I leave on the books. There is a process that allows for a reversal of one's call. You can do it within 24 hours, and you do it by simply calling the Elias Sports Bureau and indicating to them you're changing your call. But I view that in the main as being a something available if you have missed a rule, or there's something very odd or about the play, but a basic call, I wouldn't change it and have not done so.
Do you utilize replay? The replay is available?
It's better if you can make the call as soon as the play happens, again, in the interest of speed. The broadcasters particularly like us to be as quick as we can, because they're kind of left dangling. They want to be able to tell their viewers and their listeners immediately, oh, that's an error or a hit. But there are times when replay is mandatory. I find pass balls and wild pitches in those categories, primarily because of our vantage point. We're very high up, as you know, behind home plate. And when I'm looking at a pitch, I've got the batter and the catcher and the umpire all screening me from the ball, potentially. And a lot of times, I can't see if a ball hit the dirt. I can infer it when the catcher jumps up and tries to block it, but an inference isn't as good as actually seeing it from the center field camera. So in almost all pass ball, wild pitch decisions, I look at replay. Elsewhere, I use it judiciously, knowing that the broadcasters particularly they've got dead air until you give them the call.
The other thing that happens is that you're inevitably in replay going to get only a very small fragment of the field, and oftentimes where a player started from and other factors going into the play, you can only determine when you're looking at the play. So I agree with Evan. We are the highest scoring vantage point in the nation. I've established that with a contest with the people in New York. So I use it as he does, and wild pitch and pass ball. But the only other times I'd use it is if I, for some reason, I was being screened. Sometimes, for instance, where there's a throw by a pickoff to first by the pitcher, you can't tell what's going on. You have to look at the replay. But you want to try to do it as infrequently as possible.
On Tuesday night, I was at the ball game in Washington between the Nationals and the Orioles. And it was around the fifth inning. Washington had a man on first and third with one out. And the batter hit the ball to the pitcher, and the man on third was trapped in a rundown. Meanwhile, the fellow on first base was trying to move up, and he was eventually trapped between second and third. Would the batter be charged with the grounded into double play?
I'm sorry, the question is, would the batter be charged with a double, double play?
Is that grounded into the double play statistic?
No.
For a batter to be charged with hitting into a double play, it has to be what the rule book calls a forced double play or a reverse forced double play. A typical double play, short to second to first, that's a forced double play. Now, could also be the case where the out at first is recorded before the out at second. That's a reverse force double play. That's when the batter is charged with it, but not in the situation you described.
Let me add one thing that came a couple of years ago. The Pirates have a little promotion where everybody gets like a free chicken sandwich if they make a double play during a particular inning. So I had a play where it was a routine, man on first, routine grounded to short. He goes to second. Second baseman throws it past the first baseman. So the guys save it first. And the ball gets away, and the guy tries to advance from first to second, and I believe it was the catcher, comes up with the ball and throws it to the shortstop. So two outs are recorded, but because there's a misplay in between, they're not credited with a double play. So I go 6-4 first fielder's choice, 2-6 put out, no double play, no grounded into a double play. And the guy who's the announcer said, I'm not telling 20,000 people not getting a chicken sandwich.
There are some decisions you make well after they've happened. For example, assigning the winning pitcher when it's not determined by the sequence of scores and pitchers, or even possibly whether a run is unearned or earned, depending on how a batter would have or not advanced after the error. So I wonder, on those sorts of things, do you discuss it with the other people by you and come to and get some input, or how do you do that?
No, there is, when you're to score, with the exception of the postseason and All-Star right. games that we mentioned, for better or worse, it's you. No one around you is authorized to give you input. That having been said, consider this situation. You've got a ball hit to the outfield, runner on base. The outfielder relays it to one of the middle infielders, who then throws out the runner trying to advance to third or second. Well, I don't see the visiting team middle infielders every day. And sometimes in the heat of the action, I can't tell immediately if that was the shortstop or the second baseman who took that throw. So I may turn to the visiting PR representative and say, was that shortstop or second who took that, right? And prevent that situation, now this is going to sound so crazy, I look at ways of distinguishing the middle infielders, and now the third baseman is in that fray also, because he may be shifted over, right, into short right field or somewhere else for these infield shifts. So I look, is this guy wearing his socks different? You know, I know he's the shortstop. Has he got a beard, as the Pirates' third baseman has? Well, I know if the bearded guy took the throw or made the play, that's five. So that's kind of a trick in the modern era.
And I try to do that too. And 2 years ago, I had them all down. I had the socks. I had the color of the gloves. I had those kinds of things. And it was a double rundown. And at the end of the second rundown, a player catches the ball. And I look and I say, he doesn't have the socks. He doesn't have the gloves. Who in the world is that? It was the center fielder had come in and taken the throw to get the second out.
That's great. Thanks.
Hi. Sometimes I'm a bit confused on how an unearned run is charged. I mean, obviously, if there's an error in the beginning of the inning and the guy scores, or if there's an error on a play and the runner scores because of that, I know it's an unearned run. But, like, for example, I was watching the Yankees-Mariners game last night, and there's a runner in second, and then there's an error, and that runner eventually scored, and they count it as an earned run. So, like, it doesn't seem like the unearned run is, like, a perfect science, but, like, how exactly do you tell, like, when something's unearned or earned?
Well, you have, there is a very long and specific rule with respect to earned runs, but unlike a lot of the other rules that are there, there is a certain amount of judgment that's given to a score. Whenever in an inning an error or a pass ball occurs, you have to do what's called reconstruct the inning, which is basically then look at the inning as if that error or pass ball had not occurred. And then you proceed from there. As the rest of the inning develops, you make a determination. If the run score would not have scored in your reconstructed inning, that is, the third out occurs before that run would have scored, by definition, that's an unearned run. Similarly, if the player arrives on base as a result of an error, that run is also going to be unearned. So there are there's a lengthy rule, but the part of it that we are given some leeway on is how we would look at the inning. There are certain plays that occur that you could view in different ways, and it's our job to say, well, this is the way that the inning would have occurred, would have been in the reconstruction, and then we put the error, the earned run and unearned run total together.
Let me append one thing to that. In reconstructing the innings, we are advised to give pitchers the benefit of the doubt in determining how far runners would have advanced on a certain play. So if we're reconstructing an inning and we say, gee, would he have reached second or third on that hit, we're advised to assume that he would only have reached second because we're giving the benefit of the doubt to the pitcher. Just sort of one of the vague aspects of the rule book, but it is in there. We are advised to do that.
And one final thought, this past winter in New York, we had about a 45-minute debate on a very odd earned run, unearned run thing with dozens of scorers in play. And there was the official baseball historian of Major League Baseball, a guy named John Thorne. And he listened to it because he was about to address us. And he said, after it was over, he said, that's the most fascinating discussion I've ever heard, but I have no idea what you were people talking about.
What drives me crazy is the game's over, box score is published in the morning paper, and then you change a hit to an error to a hit. And you don't find out about that until days later because nothing is published. And the only reason you find out is you happen to be tracking that player, and 2 days later you see his average is different than what you might think it is. Why don't those changes get published or somehow?
Well, yeah, first of all, I mean, most of them are now occurring as a result of the appeals process. The individual player or manager has 48 hours to appeal the ruling. It then is, the detail of it is sent to us. We're asked to immediately respond. We try to do so within that same day. And then it goes through a process at Major League Baseball. If there is a change that occurs, it's almost certainly because of that. I mentioned before that a scorer can change it within 24 hours. I don't see that that doesn't happen very often. But in the situation where Major League Baseball overturns something we've done, Elias Sports Bureau indicates that they are engaged in a process, and they say they have an ability to connect with people on that. So my suggestion is, to the extent you have interest or concern about specific players or the specific changes, they should have listings of it on their website or if you call them.
Thank you.
The difficulty with that situation, as Bob describes, is that the change can occur 3 days, 4 days, 5 days after the play actually occurs, and by that time the media are on to the next game. So now, often in here, the home PR representative will make the announcement in the press box, and then if the media choose to add a line or two to their story about it, it's up to them. But that's kind of haphazard. I understand.
How many appeals might you experience during the course of a season these days?
I find that typically two or three of the calls that I make per year are reviewed, and sometimes they're upheld and sometimes overturned. So far this year, I've had one reviewed and it was upheld.
And the process has changed somewhat. And it has, I think, because of input from scorers. In the first year or two, there were a significant number of ones overturned, and they were shown to us in New York, and we, in some instances, vehemently disagreed with them having been overturned. They now have a process where they have kind of a screening of an appeal that comes in to determine whether it's sufficient to go on to their final adjudicator. And so it has significantly reduced the number of appeals and the number of overturns. I agree with Evan. Generally speaking, you're going to have just a handful during the course of the year. I've done about 20 games this year so far. I've had one that was uphill.
Gentlemen, how much are scores being paid these days, and who is paying them? By that I mean MLB or the ball clubs.
We work for MLB, and the per game rate these days is $180. With the exception of games that are postponed, as we had here last night. Now, I was scheduled to work the game, and the new guidelines, just implemented last year, I think, are that if a game is postponed 45 minutes before the scheduled start time or thereafter, and it doesn't become an official game, then we get paid at the 50% rate for that game. So instead of earning $180 last night, I'll get $90.
And I want to tell my colleague that when I was in New York, I voted against that and said he should get his full amount for sitting the 4 or 5 hours in the booth last night. But I was in the minority.
Well, I have to acknowledge that I was one of those who suggested that arrangement, because prior to that, we got paid only if the game started, right? And then you would get your full amount. My argument to MLB was, consider an evening game. I've got to drive an hour through rush hour traffic to get to the game. I may sit there for 2 hours before they call it. And you're not recognizing the 3 hours I've invested of my time. Can't we get to a fairer way where you pay something like a kill fee, which is what I experience in publishing? Give us a percentage of it. And that's when MLB went to this 50% if 45 minutes or thereafter. So, Bob, I hate to say it, but I'm one of the progenitors of that.
Well, you just gave up half your fee last night then.
Prior to the appeals process, who complained the most?
Oh, well, complaints were nightly, and they came from every possible direction. You had the public relations folks who sit in the press box, and then there would be, there's a phone in the press box, and you learned that when it rang any time after the game, they were looking for you. You heard from managers, coaches, players, trainers, ball boys, everybody and anybody who had an interest would be in touch with you. Generally speaking, their first words were, will you look at it again? It would depend, but I often would rejoin, I can only see a play live once. But it would depend. In some instances, I might say, yes, I'll take another look at it, but I found that you would get yourself on a very slippery slope if you started to reverse a lot of calls after the games because you were being asked to do so in that way.
I the most heated discussion I had was with a hitting coach. and Major League Baseball sends us its procedures for the year and how we're supposed to act and dress and so on. And we are advised that we are to be treated with respect as representatives of MLB. I don't know why they're advising us of that. I mean, they probably should be advising others. But and they say, notify us if you're not. But so when I got into it with this hitting coach, I was mindful of what MLB said, and I thought, should I call them? Nah, that's like a kid in school, you know, who's tattling on the bully. And so, but I did tell the Pirates I will never accept another phone call from him. But again, those days are pretty much gone. And as long as players are allowed to appeal calls, I don't think we'll see much of that anymore.
I think we have time for one quick last question. Thanks,
This question has to do with either the shift of positions or if the players are rotate or putting on a shift or if they're changing positions. If they've just are putting on a shift, obviously, if there's a play like a ground ball to the shortstop, but he's in a second place position, it'll be probably 6-3. If they actually change positions, and let's say the second baseman goes over to the third and third goes to second for one play, the player that made the position will obviously get a put out, let's say if it's second to first, but the third baseman is there. Is the way that they would show that in the box score that the player played both second and third during the game, and if there is no play at all, but they just shift, do they still get credit for both second and third or right and left field if they switch for one play?
Yeah, it has obviously shifts have played a dramatic role in the game recently, and there are the guidance basically is when they're done for strategic reasons over a short period, the players retain their original positions, and any putouts and assists are credited to them as if they were in their original position. There are instances where players are shifted for other than simple strategic reasons, for instance, pitchers going to the outfield, right, et cetera, then it's our responsibility to put them down as playing both positions. And, of course, there is an exception to all of the rules in baseball, and that this one happens to do with the first baseman's mitt, which has now been in I had the pleasure of being the one of the first, if not the first, to experience the first baseman's glove being tossed to another guy, and then the play occurring with the person with the new first baseman's mitt. And then the question is that the first baseman or not? And the guidance that eventually Major League Baseball gave is because only the first baseman can wear the first baseman's mitt under the rules, the player, who in this case was the second baseman and was really only shifting, becomes the first baseman with the mitt on. And so we're also responsible for indicating that on our sheets as well.
We don't, we have to take notice of shifts so that we can properly assign putouts and assists and errors, but none of that is communicated in our reports. So if you took, if you looked at our report, you wouldn't be able to tell when a shift was on. MLB hasn't asked us to do that, thank goodness. A good rule of thumb is, with noting the exceptions that, that Bob mentioned, is that the third baseman, for example, is always the third baseman. His scoring number is 5, no matter where he may field the ball. If he's in short right field and he throws a runner out at first, that's 5-3. Nothing has changed about that, no matter where he's positioned.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Maybe we could step outside because I think some more folks have questions.
Sure.
Thank you all for joining us. Please join the Scores Committee. Send us your ideas and thoughts about scoring, and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thanks for getting up early with us.